stories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. For Monday, December 15th, well into the holiday season. My name is, my name is Magnus Tiewald, and joining me in the studio today is
Steve Fan.
And we're your hosts today for Speak Up. Got a bunch of different things lined up for you. A report from Danny and his veterinary about pedestrian safety in the Lower Mainland. We also have a report about the new collective agreement between the Hospital Employees Union and the BC government, averting a strike there. Steven's here to, what are you here to talk about today?
Oh, I'm here to talk about a variety of things, but mostly kind of the arts and culture beat. There's some really interesting news coming out of Asian cinema about Wong Kar-wai, the auteur of the famous movie In the Mood for Love. This is actually
among many others.
Among others, Chongqing Express is another one. Great filmmaker, but there's some controversy regarding his treatment of staff on site.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to just kind of discuss a little bit, going into it. There was a Vancouver Turkish Film Festival a couple of weeks earlier, which I didn't get to really review, but I might get into it later on once I get into some of the films. So, quite a bit to talk about in arts and culture space.
Weather's been the big news here in BC. Well, one of the big news stories here in BC, along with court cases and Indigenous rights, which are also creating a lot of roil on social media. We'll talk a bit about, give you some updates about the weather and the roads after our first report here. And a little later in the program, we have a documentary about refugees fleeing Guatemala to come to Canada. So all that and more coming up here on Speak Up. And we're going to start off with a report from our reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, about an initiative to improve public pedestrian safety in our area.
The Walkers Caucus is an advocacy group for pedestrian safety throughout the Lower Mainland, including the cities of New Westminster and Burnaby. On December 4th, Vic Leach and Amy Wu, as representatives for the Walkers Caucus, were set up with a table at the entrance of the New Westminster Public Library. The table was covered in retroreflective materials, and their goal was to get as many passerbys as possible to stick on these materials to their common mobility devices, including canes, walkers, wheelchairs, baby carriages, strollers, carts, and other items. The goal of this event was to increase pedestrian visibility for road users, while also educating people on the risks of walking in areas with poor visibility and road-focused infrastructure. A common sentiment expressed by people who stopped by the table was that this initiative was a great idea, but they had never considered the need to increase their visibility as a pedestrian before. CJSF was able to speak with Vic Leach on the background behind this event and the lessons that he hoped it conveyed for those who passed by.
We're here to put on reflective material on canes and walkers and baby carriages, just so that when people are out at night, they can be seen by drivers of cars, because the light will reflect back to them. So that's one of the main things. We understand that in BC we have about 2,300 people that are injured from walking at night, and so those people are going to be going into the hospital, and that's things that could be changed quickly.
Vic Leach then went on to explain the increased risks that pedestrians face when walking at night.
But it's been sort of a passion of mine because of, on pedestrian safety, they said that about 50 to 60% of the injuries take place in the evening or at night. We know that somewhere around about 42% of the deaths with pedestrians takes place at night. Could be higher in certain areas. So drivers are not very good at seeing an individual when they're in dark clothing or even in light clothing because they have so many distractions as they're driving.
Later on, Vic Leach then brought up what some other countries are doing in order to effectively address pedestrian safety.
In studies, most people are not even aware in Canada that there's the United Nations has declared 2021 to 2030 as a decade of action for road safety. This is the second decade of action for road safety declared by the UN. The first one was 2011 to 2020. And we found that Norway has done the best in the world as far as we can see. And if we did a direct comparison with Norway to BC, we find that going back to a pre-COVID year in 2019, Norway had a population of 5.3 million and BC was at 5.1 million. Norway had 3.8 million motor vehicles and BC only had 3.4. So they had more vehicles, but they ended up with 380 pedestrians injured in that year, and BC ended up with 2,200, six and a half times as many. So that's why we're trying to do things. Well, they're doing some of the things, but it's we found that in Norway, one of the other things that is that they've also reduced the blood alcohol content down to 0.02. That's a federal project. We also found that you have to change the roads and pathways so that people will feel safer. So one of the other things that we're applying to do is get a definition for the term curb ramp, which is the smooth graded transition from the sidewalk to the road. That will allow pedestrians to cross the road in a little bit more time. We've been out with blind people and showing them that if the ramp goes down into the middle of the crosswalk, it's better than going into the middle of the intersection because a blind person can't see where the middle of the intersection or the middle of the crosswalk is. So those are things that we're trying to do.
Vic Leach, Amy Wu, and the Walkers Caucus continue to advocate for safer road conditions for pedestrians, as well as stricter regulations for increasingly popular modes of transportation, such as e-scooters. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
All right, the weather situation in BC. Atmospheric rivers have sort of hammered the province over the last couple, the last week or so, and apparently more are on the way. This has led to a lot of disruption with significant closures along highways throughout the province. A lot of that is cleared up with a bit of the break in the weather. Currently, Highway 3 is closed between Hope and the east gate of Manning Park. And probably that's going to be for a little while. Over 21 sites on the highway have been seriously damaged by landslides, washouts, and culvert blowouts. So that's not going to get fixed right away. Other highways are open, but alerts out for Highway 1 and Highway 5, the Coquihalla. They're currently open, could be under threat with a change in the weather or a bit of a change in conditions. So check Drive BC, which is the province's highway information website, before you head out. Make sure you're going to be able to get through to your destination. The other thing that's normally by the time we're here in December, the ski season is well underway, but none of the North Shore mountains have snow or open runs yet, which I'm sure is disappointing for many local skiers. And even up in Whistler, just over a third of runs are open and about a quarter of lifts.
Yeah, so this is kind of an issue because really, like, the ski season is supposed to start in earnest, you know, a couple of weeks before Christmas. Mm-hmm. That's kind of just the whole setup, because the season really ends in March, more or less, right? Like, and so if the season doesn't really properly start until the new year, then you really have like 2 months of skiing to go on. That just kind of starts to dilute the value proposition of these things, the annual passes and the season passes. Yeah. And even
I imagine the viability of the whole operation as a business when the season gets shorter and shorter. I mean, I know they do a lot to sort of provide activities at other seasons, but really, I mean, the ski season is the big thing.
Well, what is interesting is that it's been, you know, past years a relatively colder year this winter, but there's just been no snow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not great. It's rainy, it's cold, but there's no powder on the slopes.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of a challenging situation for everyone. And I think one thing that comes back to this kind of conversation, and this is a conversation I have with my friends who are urban planners and regional planners and that kind of thing, is it time for BC to consider having a second or third real sort of mega resort? Because there is, you know, I think there's one out in the Fraser Valley, I forgot what it's called. There's a couple, but there's nothing on the scale of Whistler.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we obviously have the natural viability of having a second genuine international ski resort, but there's just not something that's been there where any progress has been made. And I think, you know, that's kind of how you spread out the risk, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. Check your road conditions if you're planning and heading out. Hopefully these will improve for next week, because of course by the time we get to this point next week, everybody's going to be out and on the road hoping to get to family Christmas and events, and hopefully the weather won't be working hard to make that difficult for everybody. Let's talk a bit about Asian cinema, Stephen.
So Wong Kar-wai is this legendary director of, among others, In the Mood for Love, Chungking Express, 2046, as well as more recently a TV series called Blossom Shanghai. And mm-hmm. it's a TV series about the go-go years of the 1990s Shanghai. And, you know, a guy who's trying to make it big. It's a very, very popular TV series. It's actually inspired, another movie about Shanghai has inspired this huge wave of nostalgia about old Shanghai, both in its 1990s sort of configuration as well as pre-war configuration across China. And so it's a big cultural touchstone. But there's been an allegation from a technical person, from someone who worked on his sets, called Guar, who is kind of a production assistant, mm-hmm. or production editor, on his Blossom Shanghai set, essentially about mistreatment of employees. You know, he doesn't pay them properly. You know, he works them really hard. He treats them a little bit like menial servants. So, mm-hmm. you know, this guy who is actually a production editor or production assistant is being asked to, like, serve them food after he and his wife or co-producers gossiping about other people. You know, they're not, you know, this guy is having to spend his own money with his own credit card, not getting reimbursed for even something like 100 RMB, which is like $20, and they're like, "Why would you? You know, why, you're a writer. Why would you need to spend $20 on food or materials or whatever?" It's just like,
well, you know, that should all be part of the production, right?
Yeah, and it's just so it's kind of a classic kind of exploitation situation. A friend of mine actually wrote a post on this, which I haven't read yet. but you know, it's kind of the question is, to what extent does kind of taint his career? Does it taint his work going forward? But I have a different set of thoughts on this. And my thoughts are not at all exculpatory of Wong Kar-wai. But I want to place him in its proper context, in the sense that I think it's useful to go into a little bit of biographical detail about Wong Kar-wai, in a sense that he's not actually originally Cantonese. He's not from Hong Kong. His family was originally from Shanghai. His Mandarin name was Wang Jianwei. So Wang Karwai is a Cantonization of his name in pronunciation. And he essentially went to Hong Kong, I think at some point in the 1970s and so forth, you know, that tiny dribble of Chinese refugees from the communist era to kind of the quote-unquote capitalist paradise that is Hong Kong, British Hong Kong. Yeah. And so obviously, and part of the reason Chongqing Express was named that was that when he landed in Hong Kong originally, he actually lived in Chongqing Mansions, the famous, infamous, overcrowded, you could almost call it slums in Kuala Lumpur or whatever it is. And so he's kind of had to claw his way upward a little bit. When he arrived in Shanghai, when he arrived in Hong Kong, he didn't speak any Cantonese or English, and he had to learn that as a teenager on his own. saying all that is not to exculpate his actions, which I think are heinous. I think about when I hear stories about this is that perhaps, you know, his movies have this dreamy quality, but there's also this incredibly auteur-driven, this kind of decisiveness about what he's going to do. He wasn't influenced by environmental factors. He wasn't influenced by other people. He chose his own influences very carefully. He was and is and remains a very self-directed person. And what I'm trying to say is that perhaps part of his ability to just be himself and not be influenced by others, to just express purely himself, his own vision, is kind of shaped by this kind of biography of, you could call it, having to work your way on up in what is an otherwise hostile or adverse environment. So this is not, to us, this is not an unfamiliar story. This is a classic sort of immigrant story, right? First-generation immigrant story. His first, you know, you could say his first and half generation, but it associated with all the stereotypes of that, you know, the sort of the tight-fistedness and, you know, the flintiness and the rest of it. So I think in that case, it's not surprising to me. And yeah, sometimes it goes with employee, you know, exploitation. You know, let's just ask the employees at some of the first generation Chinese restaurants what they're doing. I'm Chinese, so I can say this.
Yeah.
So I get that. But I think it's hard to also separate his artistic vision, good or bad, from that. One of the reasons his movies work so well, even though they're art films, but they're also gigantic commercial successes, which is very unique, I think comes from this kind of adverse background. Because you can have a very comfortable background, you can have a very comfortable upbringing, and make beautiful art films, but they might not necessarily have the same popular resonance as his films have had.
Well, they're very human films.
And they're about human struggle, human failure, human emotion.
Human emotions. That make them, you know, I mean, they're art films in the sense that they're not intended to be easy, but nor are they difficult films.
But they all have interesting effects. They play with the light. They play with the sequence. It's not necessarily chronological.
And there's more going on in the film than is just on, you know, explicitly on the screen, which, you know, makes it interesting. A lot of meaning in them. But also, as you know, very relatable because they're really about
human struggles.
Yeah.
And human foibles and, you know, about finding love or not finding love or having love or having not being requited. And so it's very relatable everyday struggles in everyday contexts, in everyday environments, in Hong Kong and beyond. So in many ways, I think to me, this revelation, this series of revelations, it's huge on the Chinese internet, of course, marks not so much an indictment, but perhaps an end of an era.
Mm-hmm.
I think this will have some effect on his career, perhaps not as much as people think, but I think that particular of authorship, that particular era of, you know, this horrible boss kind of auteur, whether we like it or not, whatever the products that came out of it in its golden era, that's drawing to a close. And we're getting to a different era. That's just how I feel about it. It's history moving on. Yeah.
Well, if you're interested in Wong Kar-wai, I don't think I've seen all his films. I've seen several of them, and I can certainly highly recommend In the Mood for Love, an amazing film. I've saw it many, many years ago, and now off the top of my head, I can't recall whether it's in English or in Mandarin.
Which one?
In the Mood for Love.
I don't remember either. It's probably in Cantonese, but the thing that's the descriptor I read of In the Mood for Love is that it's the most profound and moving love story that does not even have a single kiss in it.
And it's don't let the potential prospect of subtitles scare you off. It's definitely a film worth checking out, along with some of his other films. I think through one of the streaming services, it will be available today for you to find.
Yes, absolutely. I got Chungking Express on YouTube. You can buy or rent it. I really want a second, Magnus's point about language not being a barrier here, because unlike a lot of Chinese language films, Cantonese language films, the language itself is used almost artistically. It's mm-hmm. not kind of this thing where purely a background filter. It's part of the story, but it's part of the story where the subtitles are actually really, really good, and it helps you understand the story and definitely appreciate the story without speaking any of the language.
Yeah, absolutely. Other filmmakers in the news, a couple of them. Woody Allen made the news this weekend, or at least a lot of brouhaha online,
yeah.
For appearing in numerous photos in the company of Jeffrey Epstein, and
that doesn't help.
And of course, that doesn't necessarily prove anything one way or the other, because Jeffrey Epstein, despite all the allegations around him, was also a bit of a New York socialite who put on a lot of events. So there's nearly everybody in sort of New York high life has a good chance of being showing up at one of his events, unconnected to the other allegations connect with Jeffrey Epstein, but it's still not a good look. And there's a huge debate on the Woody Allen subreddit on Reddit. I'm not subscribed.
Subreddit on Reddit.
It came up in my feed, and people are really taking strong positions. In other news, Rob Reiner and his wife were found dead in their home in Los Angeles.
I heard about this.
Apparently connected to their son, Nick. It's being investigated. Nick apparently suffered from some significant mental health issues. The investigation sort of is ongoing. I guess you can sort of draw your own conclusions about what might happen, but we don't really know until the police say more.
Yeah, it's one of these Hollywood, murder, suicide, whatever. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie. First of all, this is very just tremendously sad.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing is, and so I felt really sorry for the family. But this idea of this horrible, violent crime in the home of a sort of Hollywood glitterati is not just something that unfortunately has happened, but is actually part of the mythos of the Valley itself.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is really this really profoundly beautiful film about the industry looking inward at its own history and trying to come up with a product for the movie viewer to see, the culmination of that movie, the climax of it, was the famous murder by the Manson family of, actually I forgot the name.
Sharon Tate.
Yes, exactly. And that was what the entire movie was building up to. So, and it's about you know, people who are beautiful, successful, at the top of their game, being beset by this horrible tragedy that comes out of nowhere, or I should say, perhaps not out of nowhere. And it's profoundly sad, but it's also, I think, that is part of the mythos of the place itself in a pretty profound way.
I also just want to mention the tragedy in Australia this weekend at Bondi Beach in Sydney.
Yeah.
I think the death toll there from two shooters, apparently...
A father and son combo, apparently.
Yep. Is up to 16.
It's horrible.
On a Hanukkah celebration for the Jewish community that I was just going.
Yeah.
The government is saying it, and it would certainly appear to be, a terrorist inspired incident, and really quite horrible. 16 dead, over 30 injured.
Yeah,
and what would have been meant to be a wonderful community celebration, you know, turned into a horrible tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely. And remember, you know, like 16 people in what is perhaps not a huge community is a really profound loss, mm-hmm. especially in Australia. Bondi Beach is a beautiful place. It's a beautiful time of the year. This horrible tragedy has happened, and we all feel the loss.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's move on to some other news. We've sort of got into fairly dark topics, but
that was quite a sudden turn, by the way.
All right. Well, we're going to bring you something a little lighter in the form of Bird Note. And then we'll be back with a report of the new contract for the Hospital Employees Union.
This is Bird Note. Sandhill cranes are famous for gathering in the tens of thousands during spring migration in Nebraska. They roost overnight in shallow prairie rivers. Then, in the early morning, they take off. Within these massive gatherings of cranes are many smaller groups, tight-knit family units. A pair of adults might travel north with their young from the previous summer, along with grown-up offspring from several years ago. In the summer, cranes find places to nest in wetlands and open areas throughout the northern U.S. and Canada. They'll raise up to 3 chicks over the season. Sandhill crane families form a close bond. They typically will stick together for the journey south and the winter, even in large flocks. The parents will often stay together for the rest of their lives. Cranes may even recognize family members from many years ago. Researchers once observed that 2 20-year-old brothers and their mates formed a family group for the fall and winter. After decades, the family tie still held strong. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Bird Note is supported by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Learn more about the lab and their online Bird Academy at allaboutbirds.org.
Recently, the Hospital Employees Union signed a new contract with the British Columbia government, and our reporter Danny Nesvadarani had a chance to sit down with Kelly Frampton of the HEU to talk about their new contract.
On December 1st, the BC government announced that over 5,000 unionized long-term care and assisted living workers will transition to the province-wide facilities collective agreement over the next 2 years. This agreement is being made between the Hospital Employees Multi-Union Facilities Bargaining Association, the Health Employers Association of BC, and the Province of BC, aiming to improve fairness for workers and stability within seniors' care. To learn more about this agreement and what it signifies for the BC long-term care industry, we reached out to the Hospital Employees Union for an interview. We were able to get in contact with Kaylee Frampton, coordinator of policy and planning at the union, who was able to provide some background on the changes being made through this collective agreement.
We did an announcement with government